G'day, welcome to the Country Hour. I'm Warwick Long. Today, more women are studying agriculture at university than men. But is the industry keeping them? And speaking of the image of agriculture, what do you think about this statement?
I really feel that farming's given a really hard time in the media. Farmers really, I see as custodians of the land. There aren't farmers out there who are really trying to degrade natural resources. And very often we're told that agriculture is the main, is the root of all evil, really, that GM overuse of inputs leads to degradation. And what I see is actually an increasing stewardship of the land, of resources.
Maybe you can tell me what you think about that. Next, we will talk about who should be the record keeper for grain in Australia. Australian grain growers are competing in a market that's worldwide. Their price at the farm gate is determined by geopolitical problems in Asia, droughts in the US, and trade barriers in Europe, just to name a few. The world wants to know how much grain there is and where, constantly. But when it comes to knowing how much grain there is here in Australia, that's the difficulty. Andrew Whitelaw from Mercado says that problem is already hindering the market.
So I think this year has been an extremely interesting year because we had a huge crop, but everyone expected there to be a lot of carryover, but we've exported it at a record pace and we've used it domestically because we had a lot of cattle on feed. So the carryover is not quite as high as people were expecting. People were expecting potentially 10 million tonnes, but it's probably more like 6 to 7 million tonnes. But it's because we don't have a record system the same as we have in the US, we won't have an accurate figure, so it's really just estimates at that 6 to 7.
And growers have long called for better information on grain stocks and quality from companies to the market. And those companies have so far resisted. But today, East Coast Storage and Handler GrainCorp says it's prepared to give ground to farmers and accept a model where it will provide more information. Mark Palmquist is the Managing Director and CEO of GrainCorp.
Well, Warwick, I don't know if it's giving ground more than the aspect that we've always been supportive of stock information reporting. It's just our position has always been is you have to make sure that there is value in it, and the way to do that is to make sure that we have as much of the stocks reported across the whole system as we can. The proposals we've seen in the past has always been just a percentage of the stocks, and when we look at that, we just don't see any value in that because it's just not giving you the full picture.
So how would you like to see that change?
Well, I'd like to see full reporting going on. Very similar. This gets brought up to me quite a bit in saying that we should be doing what the U.S. does, and we wholeheartedly agree with that. And so the U.S. process is that there's a full reporting by both commercials and farmers of what their stocks are in their storage. So what that does then is it gives us that full picture. So we're not just getting a portion of the crop and then having to guess and extrapolate into what we think is actually out there.
So let's talk about how that model would work in an Australian situation. So you see this regular reporting happening quarterly, do you?
Yeah, so from a U.S. aspect, it's actually a quarterly report that comes out. We would look at doing it on a quarterly base, and we'd be open to looking at during the harvest time that it could be on a monthly base, just because it will give a sequence of what's coming in. As an example, today, once we get into harvest, we actually report on a weekly basis what we're receiving at our upcountry facilities.
And what's included, what information is included in that as far as the type of grain, what grain is out there and grades, et cetera?
So we're including it on a state-by-state base, and we also have what we're taking in by commodity. We're not doing it by grade, Warwick. It's very difficult for us to be able to provide that type of information. And so we haven't gone by grade, particularly if it's not all the way across and all stocks being reported.
And you're saying state by state, not port zones?
Well, I think we could live with port zones. But today we're reporting it state by state. And again, the comparison to the U.S. is they do it state by state, not by port zones.
Farmer groups have been calling for grade information to be included specifically for wheat. Why can't you provide that information?
Well, again, as we're receiving it, then it's going back and taking a look at where we brought it all in. But I'll go back to the whole point that if we provide that information, one is I really question the accuracy of that information. So what's the value in that? And two is just reporting what we're receiving in grades doesn't give you a reflection of the full crop. unless there's full reporting across the whole system.
So if there was full reporting and your information, say, was lumped in with competitors in your port zone or state, like Emerald Grain and Private Storage, for example, you'd be okay with that?
And if we had on-farm quality reporting as well.
And you think that's vital here, on-farm quality reporting and on-farm reporting in general being part of this system?
Yeah, I think from a stocks aspect, I think it is important, and it's becoming more important as each year goes by, because the on-farm storage is growing and will continue to grow. So a big portion of the stocks that are available in the country are actually sitting on-farm.
Do you think this will be enough to get farmer and other industry support? Because there's been a bit of a divide over what information should be included in something like this in the past, hasn't there?
Yeah, there has been differences of opinions. But again, for us, we've been pretty consistent. I mean, we see a value here for both farmers and the commercial industry in stocks reporting. But it's got to be reporting a very high percentage of what actually is available in stocks for that information to have any value. It actually, in my opinion, starts to go backwards if there's just segments that are doing reporting, because it doesn't paint the full picture of what the availability are of stocks.
And especially seeing what's playing out now in the Australian grain market, with a lot of grain being sucked north and the possibility now of South Australian grain even being accessed by northern markets because of a change in what people thought what stocks were where. If this report was in place now, do you think it would make a difference to the grain market and how it's operating in Australia, say, this month?
I think this year would be a great example, because you have big differences in stocks between the states across the East Coast. So, example, Queensland. We know that they're going to be short at some point in time, but we can't see what the on-farm stocks are, so we don't know how short it is. So we can't react to it in trying to get the stocks moved up there, because we don't know what stocks are available and we don't know when the feed industry is going to start getting tight.
So you could see this having a bigger impact, though, even on the domestic market than it would internationally?
Well, I think it's both. So, again, you know, reporting by port zone is kind of a highly skewed attitude towards the export side of it. But as we know, there's 9.5-10 million tons of domestic demand that's going to get fed first, either through flour mills or into an animal. And that's the one that's going to be most sensitive to understanding where stocks are. So that's why this year would be a great example, is that if we knew what the stock situation was sitting up in Queensland, as an example, all stocks, then we'd have a better understanding just what is that deficit going to be, and when do we think that they could run out of grains, and so when do we need to start positioning grain up into that area to help that feeder.
And who do you think is best to collect this information? Does it have to be government?
I think it has to be what we would consider an accredited third party. So obviously government comes to mind, because the information, one, has to be trusted and has to know that the protocol is being followed and how it's being collected, and that the information then is being collated in the proper manner.
That's Mark Palmquist, the Managing Director and CEO of GrainCorp, speaking there. Do you like what you're hearing from there if you're a farmer? Do you like what you're hearing from GrainCorp? Do you think that will be helpful for your industry? I'd love you to let us know. 1-300-977-222 is our number here on the Country Hour. 1-300-977-222. Or you can text, and we love getting your texts as always, on 0467 842 722. That's 0467 842 722. Listening to that has been the man heading the industry group calling for better grain stocks information in Australia. Andrew Wiedemann is the chair of Grain Producers Australia, and he can join us now. Welcome to the Country Hour.
G'day, Warwick. How are you going today?
I'm very well. Is that enough, what you're hearing from GrainCorp, for the industry to accept?
Look, we're very close, Warwick, and I'm really heartened by what I'm hearing, because finally, after 6 years of asking for this to be done, GrainCorp are conceding, obviously, that there are things in the industry that are not right, and this is one of them. And we have to, as an industry, work on this and try and come up with a solution that is long-term, adds value, and consistently adds value to the entire supply chain. But more importantly, for the producers that I represent, they need to be assured that a system that's put in place will give them the information that is not skewed, but is information that will actually provide value to them.
And when you say you're very close, what areas do you think will still be the sticking point between grain producers and the storage and handlers?
Well, look, in the first instance, GrainCorp is one of the bulk handlers that we're continuing to have discussions with, Warwick. So we do have a number of others. In the bigger bulk handlers, obviously, Glencore, Viterra and CBH in the west. In a more smaller fashion, we have Cargill and we have Emerald Grain. So on the east coast, they're probably the five dominant players. So ultimately, it's getting all of the players in the room at some particular point. And at the moment, we're obviously working through with each of the individual bulk handlers to try and come up with a solution without enforcing legislation. We've had meetings with the Federal Minister's Office and ABS and ABS to try and come up with some solutions. And of course, this is one of them, and we're starting to see the bulk handlers become more proactive because of the concern that they would have around being a legislated function.
And also the difficulties this year in the market as well have probably helped your cause, I'd imagine.
Well, look, it's always been sitting there, Warwick. I suppose over the last decade, we've seen a number of years where we've had poor levels of production, and supply and demand situations will occur regardless, most likely, of stocks information. But certainly at the moment, nobody expected that we would actually export as much grain as we did. I think we're certainly going to see the system's going to be short of feed barley in particular, and probably more so malt barley coming into this harvest, because the indications to growers were that all these stocks were going to be still sitting there. When without that line of sight, growers have made those financial decisions around planting options in their paddocks to plant other crops based on that. So we're going to end up with a very lopsided market on the basis that we don't have that full line of sight. So, yeah, look, there are a number of facets in terms of how stocks can provide value back to farmers, but also to the entire supply chain. And at the moment, we just have the impediment where the bulk handlers, having legacy assets left over from the deregulation process, have that line of sight. And we don't have all of the marketers who are buying grain having that same level of sight within the stock, within the supply chain.
And as far as being from grain producers, one of the ideas, the key points of GrainCorp's plan there, as we just heard, is having on-farm information included, being a major part of now grain storage in Australia. Do you think farmers will be happy to provide that information, and can they?
Well, look, at the moment, Warwick, in my mind, we're at a tipping point where we don't have the sophistication levels on farm. We've long advocated for a levy payer system in Australia where we could actually collate that information. I think that we will have a process in the future where we'll be able to do that effectively. At the moment, what we've said, and we've been saying this for 6 years now, that any grain that's stored in a commercial situation above 5,000 tonnes should be able to participate, because they would have the systems in place to be able to provide that information. But we are prepared as an industry to work together, and we will look certainly at what growers can provide, and that the information would add value to this discussion. And quite clearly, as an advert to what is occurring at the moment, on-farm storage continues to grow because of what we see as non-competition, essentially through that port zone on a Australia-wide basis. Yes, we have marketers sitting there, but when you look at the tonnages that are exported, of every 5 tonne, 4 tonne is being delivered by the bulk handlers rather than the rest of the supply chain. So I don't believe we've seen the full benefits of deregulation, and we do need to have this level of transparency that we're asking for provided to all of the industry so that we can have a fully competitive market.
And how quickly do you think this could get done? Now that GrainCorp's saying they are willing to give ground, I don't know where the other storage and handlers are, the bulk handlers are on this, but how quickly, quite realistically, could this be done?
Well, one of the objectives that we've been discussing, and I'm actually meeting with GrainCorp tomorrow, but in terms of where we need to be, the pilot program that was initiated on the back of the Wheat Industry Task Force's findings to establish a stocks reporting system, which was purely looking at wheat at the time, was actually rebuked by the three major bulk handlers, GrainCorp, CBH and Glencore. If we have an opportunity now in a bipartisan way to look at that, lift that pilot program out of the project that it was in and bring that back and then look at how that might be implemented and then work with that in the short term. We could actually have something in place for this year's harvest, Warwick. So that's something that we're certainly focused on looking at. In the longer term, if we have to go down the legislated path, that will obviously take some considerable time to enact and to put in place. But in the short term, I think that we can look at some of the work that was done previously. So again, look, we are certainly heartened by the conversations that I've just heard, certainly from Mark and his company, but obviously we have to listen to the other companies as well who we're talking to at the moment.
And the government and GRDC and ABARES, other people involved in this space, are they all keen for something to be done like you are?
Look, essentially, the Minister's office has been extremely supportive. I believe actually both sides of government, really, from talking to them, are very supportive of what we're doing. And I think that what we have asked the government is that if we can provide this without legislation, then that gives industry something that it will probably outlive legislation into the future. And we certainly have GRDC with a technical background, but in this case, it's probably more working with the ABS, the Australian Bureau of Statistics, and the ABARES, Australian forecasters. So they've actually indicated that they would really appreciate this because in the past, as I think most growers listening would understand, it's always been a guess.
Yeah, and we've had lots of criticism over those numbers in the past as well on the program. Andrew Wiedemann, thanks very much for your time today.
Look, really appreciate the opportunity, Warwick, and certainly look forward to talking to you in the future around this, and hopefully we'll have a better story to tell than we have today.
That's the Chair of Grain Producers Australia and Victorian grain grower Andrew Wiedemann chatting to us there. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's 21 past 12. If you have a bit of time, today won't be the only time I tell you about our Facebook page today, but there is a lovely little video that I have just shared, and since we've been speaking to one Wiedemann, we might as well mention some content with another one in it, looking at the Silo Art road trip, the Silo Art Trail, I believe it's being called, with all those beautiful paintings that you've seen, and we've been ticking them off one by one. This is a great bit of footage from ABC News with them all combined together with some drone footage and everything. It's up on our Facebook page now. Go check it out. Share it to your friends. It's a trip that's now on my bucket list. On The Country Hour now, let's move to wool and the wool industry now. With the so-called man in the mirror wool scandal dominating discussions in wool circles, a group of top breeders, a group of top breeders were surprised to find that chair of AWI, Wal Merriman, covertly monitored their focus group through a one-way mirror. Where does this story, though, fit in the broader history of agri-politics in the wool industry? Charlie Massey's book, Breaking the Sheep's Back, documents the rise and fall of the wool industry through the reserve price scheme. He says the industry has not learnt from the mistakes that has led to the crash in the 1990s.
Because I'd sat on wool boards and had watched and suffered like many farmers when statutory politicians who thought they were bigger than the industry itself thought they could stack an industry with a floor price scheme, and it all came tumbling down and destroyed half our customers and from after 1991. So it was Australia's biggest business disaster by a long way. In today's terms, about 20 billion. HIH was about 5, I think. And the story hadn't been told, but because I'd seen the inside story after sitting on wool boards, I thought I would expose it, which I did, and that was what led to the book. One of the factors that comes out of it is that if you step away from letting market forces and your customers drive the agenda and think that you can drive the agenda yourself, either stacking it with a floor price or picking favourites in promotional work using statutory farmer funds, you're really working against healthy market factors, particularly the innovators, the real innovators who tend to be your designers and others in places like Italy, etc. And a key pattern is that we've had some pretty big egos over the years. I won't mention names, but obviously Bill Gunn was one of them, sort of a series of, if you like, emperors who thought they could run the show and dictate or change the direction and impose it on a whole global industry. Look, I haven't got involved in the wool politics since. I've walked away from, not that I was ever a politician in the wool industry, which I think is why I wasn't well liked by the agri-politicians, but there's a famous word I used in that economists taught me called rent seeker, which is what pretty much most of the agri-politicians are. It's where you have people deriving rent, which can be kudos or money, out of a system without really contributing to it. And that's pretty much what the agri-politicians have done and are still doing, in my view. And when you look at the since the collapse of the floor price scheme, the shenanigans at board table level and the vested interests, whether it be over mulesing, when there are viable alternatives or other issues, nothing's changed. You get that political situation with lots of statutory funds, you're going to attract certain types of people, including wool emperors. And personally, I haven't seen anything that's changed. And my view has always been that if we really want it to work well, let the market do it, let the innovators, our customers do it, rather than a bunch of agri-politicians who try and run an organisation using wool growers' money that they could better invest elsewhere.
So does the chair, Wal Merriman, have a future? Is it tenable that he can remain the chair of AWI if, after the things that you've pointed out have gone wrong systematically and seem to still be the issue that we're seeing at the moment?
Look, I'm not going to get into personalities, but speaking generally, I would think that if participants in a particular industry review feel that they can speak freely and honestly without any Big Brother type observation or oversight, and if that's compromised, well, then I think it raises some serious questions.
That's Charles Massey, wool grower and author of Breaking the Sheep's Back, speaking there to Josh Becker. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's 26 minutes past 12. Let's head to find out some funds that are coming from Canberra right now. Overnight, the federal government announced more details over how $1 billion, the $1 billion windfall Landcare received in the budget, will be spent. Environment Minister Josh Frydenberg announced the bulk of it, $450 million, will go to the Regional Land Partnerships Program, which currently funds the government's network of 56 Natural Resource Management, NRM, organisations. $5 million will be shared among community and volunteer groups in grants of up to $50,000. Sally Dacus spoke to Rod Knight, the CEO of Landcare Tasmania, about what this allocation means.
Well, as has been the case right through the recent history of Commonwealth announcements on Landcare funding, it's very big on numbers and short on detail. So we still, despite this announcement coming out, we still know very little about what that money will be spent on and who will have access to it. What does concern me a lot about particularly that that element of Minister Frydenberg's announcement of $5 million to go to community and volunteer groups is that's only 100 projects around Australia over a five-year period. And it's a drop in a bucket compared to what's really needed. And it looks like it could be a continuation of the recent years where community and volunteer groups have not had reasonable access to funds.
What should the share be of the total?
Look, I wouldn't go about professing to say what the share should be. What we would really like to see more of from the Commonwealth is genuine consultation about how these funds should be made available and who can access to them. What worries me about this announcement is whether what happens from here forward will actually be consultation or whether it will just be the Commonwealth telling people how it's going to be, which is certainly what they've done in the past.
Have you been trying to talk to the federal government about the money?
The Landcare movement nationally and in every state has been trying to talk to the Commonwealth ever since the $100 million for Landcare was announced in 1st of December 2016. And in that time, we've had no meaningful consultation with the Commonwealth and not one cent has flowed. And in the current case, that $100 million has completely now disappeared from the discussion.
So let's just background that $100 million. That was $100 million that the federal government announced as a part of the reform of the backpacker tax?
That's right. It was a deal done between the Greens and the government in the closing hours of that debate. And we were given assurances that some of that money would start to flow last financial year. Not only did it not flow, there's been no consultation about it, and it's now disappeared from the discussion, because what we're talking about now is the later announcement of $1 billion from the budget, but no mention of the $100 million, which was from the previous financial year.
So you think they've just tucked it into the $1 billion announcement and saying it's part of that?
We'll just have to wait and see on that. I'd be certainly very disappointed if that's what they've done.
Where's the other $500 million?
That's, again, a bit unclear, and this is why this announcement is a bit perplexing. This announcement has been made by Minister Frydenberg. We do know that there's been a lot of discussions between Frydenberg and Deputy Prime Minister Joyce about it, and you know, it may well be that the balance of the money is what is actually delivered through his portfolio in agriculture.
So half of the Landcare money goes to farmers?
Look, I don't know the details on that yet. We'll just have to wait and see.
You're tuned to the Tasmanian Country Hour. We're talking with the CEO of Tasmanian Landcare, Rod Knight, about the overnight announcement of the allocation of $450 million from the federal government for Landcare. Let's just talk about that $450 million. It's going, as I said, to the NRM groups, but no criteria so far. What sort of criteria do you think, you know, the Landcare movement needs?
Look, I think, and we've made no secret of the fact that we are very strongly supportive of processes that are competitive, so that funding is made on a merits basis. But one of the things we're very keen to ensure is firstly that community Landcare groups have reasonable access to funds, and also we want to see the Commonwealth, and this is a fairly important point, recognise the role that the state and territory Landcare organisations play in leveraging better outcomes from funding, because that's what we do. We support and facilitate the work of the volunteer community Landcare movement, and it generally delivers far more in outcomes than what actually comes in cash.
That's Rod Knight, the CEO of Landcare in Tasmania. You're obviously listening to the Victorian Country Hour. Do not adjust your sets. It is 29 minutes to one. We'll chat a bit more and head to your texts shortly, but let's head to regional news headlines now and find out what's happening around the state. Robert French is there for us today. Good afternoon, Robert.
Good afternoon, Warwick. Making news, the Greens have stepped up calls for a royal commission into allegations of water theft in the Murray-Darling after reports the Basin Authority knew about the claims months before a damning Four Corners investigation. Guardian is today reporting the authority was aware of evidence of possible water theft in New South Wales, but had concluded it was flawed. The Greens say the reviews announced by the federal and New South Wales governments don't go far enough. The owner of the Hazelwood coal mine in the state's east is investigating an earth movement of the mine's eastern batters early this morning. Engie says it happened when material at the base of an overburden dump shifted, but no one was nearby at the time. It's advised WorkSafe and the Victorian government of the incident. Police are appealing for information after someone shot at a turbine at the Warborough wind farm in western Victoria. There have been six similar incidents reported to police since the wind farm opened 7 years ago. Detectives say the shootings pose a risk to maintenance staff working inside the turbines. And a Gippsland umpire has been selected to oversee this weekend's AFL Grand Final at the MCG. Leon Gather's Matt Stevic has already umpired four Grand Finals, and he'll also be on ground for the clash between Richmond and Adelaide. He says there are always nerves before a big game, and he'll be putting his hand up to take the first bounce. For more stories, you can head to our website, abc.net.au/news.
Thanks, Robert.
Streaming right around the world, you're with the Country Hour, Australia's longest-running radio show.
We're on our way to the weather. We were speaking about GrainCorp actually saying they're prepared to give some ground and adopt a US-type model on grain stocks reporting in the country. We were speaking about that at the start of the program. Jeremy at Mullamine has sent a text to 0467 842 722. Hi, Warwick. The bulk handlers and the trade are always trying to mine producers' production level and stocks. Quid pro quo. Show us yours and we'll show you ours. That's from Jeremy at Mullamine. Thanks very much for that text. And Kevin's been dobbing me in as a Crows supporter to all and sundry. Thanks for that, Kevin. I'm happy to be identified as a Crows supporter because, of course, we are going to win on the weekend. And it's just great to be in a grand final. If you're looking for a bit more fun than me being a Crows supporter, up on our Facebook page for Victorian Country Hour at the moment, we've been, well, celebrating a lot of farmer fails this month on the page. But before that, we were talking about, well, things that you lost from the farm, from the kitchen or the house out to the farm. And Tim sent us this great late entry that we had to share. He says, a late entry for things that go missing from the kitchen. I saw this at a nearby dairy farm. It's a picture of a star picket with an upside down mug on it that's being used as an insulator. So through the handle on the mug, the electric fence tape is running. It's a genius idea. I think it's absolutely brilliant. Go and check that out on our Victorian Country Hour Facebook page. Share it to your friends. I think it's an idea that we could all well adopt. A few people might need some locks on their kitchen cabinets if it gets widely adopted. Some comments on that. Christine says, this is exactly where all those ugly giveaway cups should be. And Eileen says, it used to happen all the time at our place till the cupboard was empty and you'd walk along the cow lane to pick them all up. And Rachel with a final comment. When you're living on 2 minute noodles, but you need to keep the moo cows in. She's having a bit of a laugh at that as well. So go check that out. That's up on our Facebook page, Victorian Country Hour on Facebook. And you can like our page while you're at it. And we'll like you back. Stephen King can tell us, we like him too. He can tell us all about the weather at the moment and what's happening today and for the next week ahead. G'day, Stephen.
Oh, hey, Warwick, I like you too. Actually, I like the ABC Goulburn Murray page. I should like your one after lunch.
Come around. Although we like them as well. So there's just a lot of liking going on at the moment. But you know what? Beautiful. They won't like us, though, if we don't talk about the weather, will they? Out of my window in Shepparton right now, it looks quite overcast today.
Yeah, well, there's a fair bit of cloud around Victoria, at least earlier on this morning. And looking on the radar, it looks very promising with quite a lot of radar echoes right across the state. But once you look at all the rain gauges, there's really little of that rain reaching the ground. In fact, I don't think we've recorded any more than a millimetre anywhere in Victoria, sort of up to 9 o'clock or since 9 o'clock, which is unfortunate. But it was also pretty much as forecast as well. So that's something we can
notch it up as a win.
Yeah. But yeah, that cloud is clearing from the northwest. So the Mallee and most of the Wimmera are pretty much fine and sunny at the moment, getting up to the 20s. And so the other, well, half of the cloud is going across New South Wales. Again, that's not really doing anything in terms of rainfall. And then the rest of it's sort of pushing off down to the south. So most of the southern parts should see some sun by the afternoon. And we've got temperatures getting up to the mid-20s in Gippsland, although only about 20 in the Latrobe Valley, low 20s around Melbourne, 19s around the southwest, and low to mid-20s right across the north, even getting up to 29 in Mildura today. For the rest of today, all that rain will clear, but we will just see some showers and possible thunderstorms develop in the southwest later on today, and I think that's the only significant rainfall we can expect, maybe, you know, a millimetre or two down the southwest coast this evening. Looking into tomorrow, the warmest weather is basically today. So tomorrow is a bit cooler with mid-teens in the southwest, high teens, low 20s, basically everywhere else. In terms of rainfall, we'll see some showers redevelop, but then they'll be mainly sort of on and south of the ranges and then just contracting to the coast and parts of the northeast in the evening. Again, just a possibility of a thunderstorm down near Cape Otway and Wilson's Prom first thing in the morning, but that should go away pretty quickly. What else we got? Westerly winds. And then going into Friday, the winds go back around to the west-northwest. So the showers will clear. They'll clear late Thursday and then they redevelop on Friday. Probably in the afternoon. If anyone's coming down to the city for the grand final parade, I don't know why you would bother. Actually, do the people outside of Melbourne get the public holiday?
Yes.
So it's all Victoria.
Public holiday.
It's not like Cup Day's only Melbourne, isn't it?
No, we get a public holiday as well. Some of us, Stephen. I'll be broadcasting from an orchard on Friday.
Oh, right, that sounds lovely.
So it'll be fun anyway. But
are they going to get some cheap labour out of you as well? You'll be picking some fruit?
No, we always work. Public holidays will be a bit of fun to be out, hopefully in good weather for the grand final day parade.
Getting on to that. Friday, so yeah, across the north, it shouldn't be too bad up there. Might just see a shower or two in the afternoon, but mainly just along the ranges. Yeah, most of the, where'd you say, Shepparton?
Yeah, Maroopna, I think, will be, but yeah, Maroopna. Basically.
Yeah, Shepparton. I reckon you'll be right there. Bit of cloud up there, but nothing too bad. And what do we got up there? About 18, 19 degrees. That's pretty much perfect up there.
And so there's not a lot in those rain events. What is there much?
No, in the whole forecast, there's not really much rain, and there's no heat as well. All that heat that you would have seen in the news over sort of New South Wales and more Queensland, I think, are going up for a 43 somewhere inland New Queensland today, which possibly could be a record. None of that really makes it down to Victoria over the next week, which is good news. But unfortunately, there's no real decent rainfall over the next few days. So just getting back to Friday, Saturday, a cold front comes through to redevelop those showers later on Friday. They'll continue Saturday morning, but then should clear, should be fine for the game in Melbourne. But a little on the chilly side, so we've got 16 at the moment for Melbourne. Mid-teens in the south, high teens in the north. So good barbecue weather up in northern Victoria, if anyone's doing that on Saturday. And then the rest of the forecast, there's not really much around. There's a couple of clearing showers on Sunday, and then the rest of the showers will be mainly on the sort of west coast and the west Gippsland coast, sort of Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. But as mentioned, no real return to heat. So temperatures either around average or a little above by Tuesday, Wednesday. We're getting back up to almost reaching 30 up at Mildura, but everywhere else still in the 20s.
Spring weather, finally, for spring. Yeah, after beautiful. Not having much. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
And I don't think that information will be very good for Luke, who did tweet earlier today, things are turning bad here in northern Victoria, fielding lots of calls this morning from concerned croppers re-haymaking. Going to be interesting. So rain on the horizon. I think crops are starting to dry out.
Yeah, we did. I think we did have a call from one of the hay cutters this morning, wanting to know, he needed, 3 days of no rain just to get it cut. But so is it all drying out too early, or there's not enough hay to cut?
Need a bit more rain to keep the crops going, so they turn into grain rather than cutting them for hay. Yeah.
Yep.
But that's Stephen, thanks for that. Anything else we need to be aware of, I suppose, warnings-wise, or anything on the horizon?
Look, there's a couple of coastal wind warnings out, but no, nothing really much else to worry about at the moment.
Great to talk to you, Stephen.
You too.
That's Stephen King at the Weather Bureau taking us through the weather situation for the next week or so. Not a lot of love, really, for, as you heard, those northern guys are looking for some rain, but you're down in the southwest, you're probably happy not to be getting much, are you? So it's a wide and varied state, Victoria. This is the Country Hour. It is 19-1. Let's head to the agronomy conference, which has been going on in Victoria this week. A leading international agronomist says Australia is in a unique position to lead the world in agricultural research. Professor Ken Giller from the University of Wageningen in the Netherlands opened the Australian Agronomy Conference in Ballarat yesterday. He says agricultural research is back in fashion because food has become a geopolitical issue.
I work particularly around the area of nitrogen fixation in grain legumes, so looking at the major staple grain legumes crops, so that's the beans, cowpea, pigeon pea, groundnut, and we're looking at opportunities for intensifying farming by increasing the yields of those crops, but also diversifying, because many of the farming systems in Africa, farmers grow 90% of their land to maize or cassava, to single staple crops with a very limited crop rotation and diet. And there are real benefits of getting a more diverse rotation in and increasing productivity at the same time.
And you're working with local farmers and communities to do that, or local organisations?
Sure. So we work through both international and national organisations. We actually got work in 11 countries. The program I lead is called N2 Africa, Nitrogen to Africa, which is funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. It's a $30 million investment, actually, that project. But it's got an aim of reaching over 500,000 farmers. So we really work at large scale with large numbers of farmers, trying to ensure that we deliver, if you like, technologies directly to the farmers. Yeah.
You were quite critical of some of the ideas behind sustainable farming and the UN reports.
Well, I really feel that farming's given a really hard time in the media. Farmers really, I see, as custodians of the land. There aren't farmers out there who are really trying to degrade natural resources. And very often we're told that agriculture is the main, is the root of all evil, really, that GM overuse of inputs leads to degradation. And what I see is actually, certainly in Europe, but I think in other parts of the world, an increasing stewardship of the land, of resources, using resources very efficiently, where input levels are actually going down while yields are maintained or increased. And I think people underestimate both the skill of the researcher and the farmer in terms of the innovation that's going on there. I'd really say as well, I think Australia has a unique position in this. One of the great things here is that you have a very close link between the funding agencies like the Grain Research Development Corporation Council, the RDC, and the farmers. So there's a very direct articulation of the farmers' questions and problems, which are then addressed by researchers. And the funding is actually coming through those channels. What happens in other parts of the world is that it's often a research council who is determining what the priorities are for research, and they're often very divorced from the ground and from the farmers themselves. So I think Australia has a unique position in this because you have this very close interaction between the growers themselves and the researchers, and an interdependency which is very productive in terms of getting good research done targeted to the right questions.
You also mentioned in your speech before that agriculture is considered a bit of a dirty word, well, was, but that agronomy is making a little bit of a comeback. Why do you think that is?
Well, it's really the attention that switched from what was originally an attention on agriculture itself to the attention on food security and the realisation that the world is facing future challenges of sufficient supply of nutritious food in the right places, both in terms of which crops are grown, the prices that it's available at, and the distribution of that food. So food's gone from being a purely an issue of diet to being a geopolitical issue as well. And that's really raised the attention for agriculture research very much.
That's Professor Ken Giller, an agronomist. A word I say every day and I couldn't spit it out. From the University of Keening in the Netherlands, speaking there with Jess Davis. You're listening to The Country Hour. And there are now more women than men studying agriculture at university in Australia. Charles Sturt University Professor Jim Prattley has been researching the evolution of agricultural education for women and has published a paper, Agriculture from Macho to Gender Balance. And while gender balance has been achieved in the classroom, Professor Prattley says there needs to be more work done to retain women in the agricultural workforce.
If we go back in history, in the 1800s, late 1800s, politicians decided that specialist agricultural institutions should be developed. It's the only sector in the economy that had these special education institutions. And we had a range of them, from agricultural high schools to agricultural colleges of different types across Australia. And one thing that was common to them were that they were for boys. And so it wasn't until the 1970s that changed. And so we had the best part of a century of education in agriculture that women weren't allowed to enter. That all changed in the 70s, and we've now evolved a bit later than general population, but we're now right on target with the general population in terms of having a slight majority of women in our university agriculture courses.
And is that across Australia that these figures come out? What's that figure sitting at?
Yes, that's the national figure. So since 2003, we've had more women enter agriculture courses than men in universities, but it's about 52-48, and the national average is about 54-46. So agriculture is right on the national average, and that's actually something to be celebrated, I think. We're now an industry sector that welcomes women into the workforce.
And why do you think more women are being attracted to a career in agriculture?
Well, why wouldn't you be? It is a great industry to belong to. What we do is really important. Yeah, we produce the food and fibre that sustains our population. We contribute enormous amounts to our export earnings. And so the range of occupations within agriculture is immense. And so there's room for everybody there. And I think everybody's starting to see that now.
Is there any particular area of study women are pursuing more when it comes to agriculture?
Yes, we've had a look at that, and I have to say that nothing really stands out. You could say that more of the graduates are male that go back on farm and into the rural financing area. More women perhaps go towards the livestock area. But in general, they're in all of them. And I don't think that there's a particular bias or interest that we can say is gender-based.
And then I guess once they leave the agricultural institutions, how does the pay work out when they enter the workforce?
We don't have extensive studies on that, but what we do have shows that women are paid the same as men when they first start. But of course, there are some compromises in women's careers with families in particular, and so the longer time from graduation, the gap starts to increase. And so I think we need to look at that a bit more seriously as a sector and say, well, what can we do to ensure that we're using the talents of 50% of our workforce?
Have you got any ideas yet of how women can be more supported in the workplace?
Well, I think particularly in the private sector, I'm not sure that they've fully caught up with the fact that we've got so many women coming into our area now. And so I think we need to think about workplace arrangements. And so everything from childcare to flexible working hours, you know, just the things that are spread across other sectors of the community, and the public service leads the way there, I guess. But it's more about just a wake-up call. Let's see whether we can't facilitate a better continuity of career for women as they go through life raising families.
That's Professor of Agriculture at Charles Sturt University, Jim Prattley, who has written the paper Agriculture from Macho to Gender Balance, speaking there to Cara Jeffrey. You're listening to The Country Hour. Let's head to text just for a moment on 0467 842 722. That's our text number, 0467 842 722. Fiona from Bullaroog says, "Hi, Warwick. I just saw a post on the Country Hour Facebook page with you wearing the wrong football jersey. It should be Richmond colours because we will win the grand final." Thanks very much for that text, Fiona. Although I'd go to the supermarket and get some tissues ready, Fiona, just for the weekend. Always helps to be prepared for the outcome that's highly likely. 0467 842 722. A few more of your texts coming up later, but let's head to markets now. Let's start today with Lee and Gather Cattle. Brendan Fletcher's there for us. G'day, Brendan.
G'day, Warwick. There were 170 fewer at 800 with the usual buying group present but not all operating in a cheaper market. Quality declined with very few prime lots and dairy cows dominating the sale. There was very little demand for trade cattle. The steers and bullocks were mostly Frisians, which eased 12 cents. Cows sold from 5 to mostly 10 cents easier, with processors loading heavyweights for an estimated 419 to 451 cents a kilogram carcass weight. Heavy bulls slipped 7 to 17 cents. Grown steers and bullocks reached 275 cents. Heavy Frisian manufacturing steers, 215 to 218. Most light and medium weight cows, 159 to 193. Heavyweights, 188 to 232. And heavy bulls, 220 to 259. This is Brendan Fletcher reporting for MLA.
Stay with cattle and head to Warrnambool. Good afternoon, Eric Gastrain.
There was a smaller yarding of 431 cattle at Warrnambool, and quality was mixed for the current following of buyers. Demand remained steady, but cow prices were mostly 15 cents lower, and grown heifer sold 10 to 15 cents cheaper. Grown steers were back 5 to 10 cents, but young cattle remained fully equal on their cheaper levels of the last few weeks. The odd C2 and C3 dealer made 290 and 280 cents, two B2s at 324 cents a kilogram. The few C2 and C3 yearlings were from 252 to 285 cents, and restockers paid 235 to 256. Most D and E muscle one score yearlings were between 130 and 180 cents a kilogram. C3 and C4 grown steers sold from 240 to 260 cents, restockers going to 264. Most E1 cows were between 120 and 170 cents, with the best sales to 180. D1 cows were from 150 to 180 cents, and D2 grades were at 190 to 200 cents a kilogram. Heavyweight C3 to C5 cows made 210 to 230 cents. Eric Australian reporting for MLA.
Thanks very much for that, Eric. Lucky last in the cattle run is Wodonga. Let's head to Leanne Dax.
450 cows and 58 bulls sold to a small contingent of processors. The market did lose traction, with some cows selling with little bidding. The market did fall 10 to 17 cents, heavy cows 206 to 225, with a single pen of European cows out to 232, the middle run of stock 184 to 220, plain types 155 to 188, dairy cows 175 to 211, bulls slipped 2 to 7 cents, the better shapes 235 to 262. I'm Leo Dax, MLA.
To sheep and lamb market reports now, let's head to Hamilton. Good afternoon, Tim Delaney.
Good afternoon. A smaller limited selection of 209 lambs, 200 less at Hamilton, and a similar number of 505 sheep ready to reduce core of usual buyers. Quality of the lambs was from average to plain, with the clean-up pen lot sold preparing up for the upcoming spring lamb selling season. The sheep were a mixed crossbred of Renos from heavy to medium in weight with less plain light lots. Restocks are active at times, paying $61 from Reno lambs, $90 from Reno ewes, $88 for weathers, and also $125 for crossbred ewes. Lamb prices sold an easier trend of $5 to $7 across the market, and the sheep also showed a weaker trend from mostly $5 to $9. Light two-score lambs sold from $65 to $88, averaging 513 cents. Medium tray weight two and three scores between $90 and $115, averaging an estimated 500 cents. Few lots of heavy tray weights, a heavy lamb sold from $118 to a market of $135. Medium two and three-score sheep sold from $60 to $88, and Merino ewe mutton averaging 370 cents. Heavy crossbred ewes three-score sold from $85 to $90, average $290. Extra heavy ewes, four scores made from 100 to 103 as they averaged 265 cents. Merino weathers and medium weight, two and three scores made 72 to 93. Heavy rams of all breeds made between $32 to $60. This has been Tim Delaney reporting for MLA Hamilton.
Thanks very much for that, Tim. And Graham Pimer is lucky last for us today at Horsham Sheep. G'day, Graham.
Good afternoon, everyone. Lamb supply is lifted by over 8,000 heads to 14,200. Mostly new season young lambs were penned at Horsham this week. Quality was mostly very good, as young lambs show more maturity and finish. The buying group attended and operated in a market ranging from around firm and to $5 at easier. Heavy young lambs reached $185 to be near firm. The heavier trade weight selling from $142 to $154, average around 595 cents. Old lambs made to $149. Merino lambs mostly sold from $101 to $117. Restock was paid from $106 to $119 for young lambs. A lot of pens sold from $50 to $85. About 3,450 sheep still to be sold. Tradeway three-score lambs range from $118 to $130 and average around $590. The trade weight sold from $142 to $154 at around $595. Export three- and four-score lambs sold from $152 to $185. They're averaged about $590. Every hog that's made to $120. Been Graham Pimer at Horsham for LA.
And a little bit earlier in the program, we were talking about Charlie Massey, who's the author of the book Breaking the Sheep's Back. He was saying, talking about the current leadership of AWI not learning the mistakes that led to the past crash of the wool industry in the 90s. A few texts on that. I believe it's Marius at Glen Thompson that's texted, Charlie Massey selling his book again. Wool is booming. Start reporting the positives. AGM in November. Let growers decide the future. Eric's taken a different view and sent a text saying, Charlie is spot on. All our industries are suffering from so-called agri-politicians. Our grassroots farmers are not represented by leadership who have had their well-being at heart. Many of our leaders only put their futures and climbing further up the ladder as their challenge. We need a new model, says Eric. Thanks for your text. You can keep them coming. 0467 842 722 is our text number. 0467 842 722. It's the same text number for Nicole Chavastek. I'm sure she'll want you to text her this afternoon, won't you, Nicole?
Hello, how you doing?
I'm very well. Now, I was a bit disappointed. There was too much Tigers content on your show yesterday. I'm going to make a complaint. I want some more balance here.
Why don't you ring up Warwick from Warrabalanga and say that you're a Crows supporter and that this is outrageous.
Wazza from Kyala. That's me.
Wazza from Kyala. We'll know it's you. And then you can have your little vent, Waz.
Oh, done. Done. Then I'll probably have to let Tigers fans go on air on this show.
And rebut.
That won't matter. Yes. Oh, that's not happening. What's on your show today?
The Greens stepping up their calls for a royal commission into allegations of water theft in the Murray-Darling after these reports that the Basin Authority knew the claims months before the damning Four Corners investigation. We're also going to have a look at a wedding venue in regional Victoria, in central Victoria, in fact, which has gone bust, leaving a number of couples stranded. And we're going to ask, who would be the Australian royal family? Are we talking Chopper Reid and Shane Warne, or do we need to reach higher?
In our I think we can do better than that.
Righto, off you go then, Ross.
I don't know. It would have been Sir Donald Bradman back in the day, wouldn't it?
Of course.
Although he was controversial in his own right. But
Sir Don, yeah, we'll put him on the list.
I'd take him over Shane Warne.
Anytime?
Yeah, I think so.
Nominations for Australia's royal family on Statewide Drive this afternoon.
As long as it's no one from New South Wales, okay?
Now, everybody from New South Wales who just heard that comment, direct your complaints directly to Wazza from Kyalla. You know where he lives.
Will do. That show's on at 3 o'clock this afternoon. That's it for the Country Hour today. We'll join you again tomorrow. It's 1 o'clock.